Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ideas in writing.
Hello and welcome to Ideas in Writing. Do you like the theme tune? Yeah, I thought I'd change it from the last one. It's a kind of podcast with me, Philip Holden, and it's about all kinds of writing and words you might read, words you might hear or see in books, online, on the screen and on the stage, and everything it takes to turn them from ideas in someone's head into writing. It's supported by Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, of course, and we've started to upload the conversations we've had so far at events, mainly at the old fire station in Tunbridge, which is just around the corner from the bookshop. But I'm also having more intimate conversations with interesting people from my home studio. It's kind of a little office where I've got a microphone and stuff, using a great bit of software called Zencaster. So Mr. Books is an independent bookshop in Tunbridge, the home of inspiring, imaginative and intelligent books, gifts and conversation. You can find it at mrbooks.co.uk and order all kinds of books, new and secondhand. But obviously it's better to visit them when they're open, which they're not at the moment. And we'll talk a little bit about the effects of lockdown later on, I guess. Ideas in Writing is available on Anchor FM. But it's also available on other platforms, including Spotify. So just search for Ideas in Writing. And in these interviews, I've asked my guest to come along with a word that means something to them. It could be a memory or a watchword. And I'm also offering them a word that I've brought along, probably picked quite randomly. So Ideas in Writing is going to be an occasional series of interviews and conversations. And this one is with Ian Tucker Bell, who's an old friend of mine. Ian's a writer and composer and also a teacher of drama. Ian and I have worked together several times on shows at the Oast Theatre, and I've directed a couple of Ian's shows which have been up to the Edinburgh Fringe. Ian's shows are always well received and tackle some quite serious subjects with humour and often with music. But for COVID-19, his latest project, Hymn to Canada, would have been in rehearsal for The Fringe, which, as you may know, has been cancelled. So in this chat, we're still getting used to some of the technology, so there's a bit of chat about that. And there was a slight break in the recording. And also a warning, there's one slightly sweary word in here. So Ian brought along a word, journey, which I swapped for a slightly pretentious word, palimpsest. And we talked about whatever came up. How Ian writes stories, what stops him writing, what stops us all doing the things we want to do, and how he's developed over his time as an artist. So So here we are with the first episode. This is called Journey, Palimpsest with Ian Tucker Bell.
Hey, there we go.
That's great, isn't it? Technology. Anyway, yes. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Kind of just enjoying a bit of freedom and a bit of time to make things, and that's kind of how I'm getting through lockdown, really.
Yeah. You see, I don't feel as if I've got any more time at all. In fact, if anything, I feel as if, well, there's a couple of things. One is I think I've still got loads to do, and yeah, sort of people expecting me to do things professionally, that is, you know, that I get paid for. And there's a lot of pressure to be creative, isn't there? I mean, to do stuff.
There's certainly a lot of activity going on. And I think in weak moments, you kind of think, oh, I should make something because other people are making something and I've not made something for a little while. And I'm kind of trying to park that and thinking, well, why am I making things? And I'm kind of doing it, A, because I enjoy it, and B, because it's kind of good for my brain. Otherwise, I sit and I mope.
And I
let lockdown get to me. Whereas if I'm writing something or making something, I'm in a much better frame of mind.
Yeah. Do you find, I mean, you know, kind of leaping into the creative process now, but do you find you get into a flow quite quickly? Or do you get distracted easily?
I think I've learned a lot about my creativity over the last couple of months, actually, because I've been forced to do it in a way, whereas previously I'd have done a bit here and there and fitted it around, you know, being in shows at the Oast or doing all kinds of other things, whereas, you know, visiting friends and stuff. Whereas I've had all this concentrated time and it's been, I think it is easy to get distracted, you know, social media, whatever. We've got a puppy that loves our attention. It's very easy to get distracted, but at the same point I've learned that just the good thing is sitting down in front of a blank screen and creating something, you know. Sometimes when I don't even know what I'm going to create, I've kind of learned that I can do it rather than having to have a million ideas in my head to sit down and do them with. I can just sit down and, you know, I can generate, which is quite nice.
I mean, you know, I don't know how long we've known each other, but a few years.
I think
I've seen that progression anyway, way before lockdown, that sometimes you just have to, as you say, sit down in front of a blank screen and produce something without necessarily knowing what it's going to be.
And I think you're right. I think in my head in the past, I've kind of thought, no, I've got to wait for that moment of inspiration and that thing that will make sense of it, and then it will come. Whereas I think what I've learned recently is actually, you know, sit down and write, and actually the inspiration will come because you're writing. And there was a film years ago, a Sean Connery film. Oh, hang on, my machine's making... Let me turn my email off. That won't beep coming. Again.
That's all right.
God, this is a problem with technology. Things beep at you. There was a film years back, I think it was one of Sean Connery's last films, called Finding Forrester. Did you ever see Finding Forrester?
No, I didn't.
Ah, Finding Forrester is a good film. And it's basically about a young man who wants to be a writer, and Sean Connery is this aging writer who's a bit of a hermit, who ends up mentoring him. And one key thing that happens at the start is the kid's like, well, I don't know how to write. I don't know what to start with writing. So he gives him the first two sentences from something he's previously written, you know, the character Sean Connery's character's previously written. And he uses that then to springboard into his own writing, and it was the process of having something to start, got it going. You know, it's like, you know, the ignition on a car. And sometimes I think, oh, that's not there. I can't drive this car. When actually you sit in the car, you turn the key, and you go. God, that sounds.
And I suppose no. Well, but that's okay, because I think the analogy is that you have to trust that you don't know where you're going.
Yeah, absolutely.
That it's worth going.
And I think as well, you've got to trust that you're bright. You know, when working with you guys in the theatre and in the rehearsal room, we play, we throw ideas around, we try things. And it's actually, do you know what? I can do that on my own head. and ideas will come out, and that's quite nice.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Actually, do you know what? I really miss that. I was thinking that the other, a few weeks ago, actually quite early on in this, I was thinking, I really want to be in a rehearsal room. It doesn't matter what you're rehearsing, absolutely, whether it's something that's fully scripted or there's just something great about playing with that. I was thinking about, you know, directing and so on.
I might throw an idea at you then.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what now?
I have something in my head that I want to do. I'm kind of thinking how to do it. And it could be something you could do.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. So, I mean, what I've also done is I've uncovered things that I've written before.
Yeah.
Or I'd even forgotten that I'd written. I don't know whether you remember a story I wrote called The Girl Who Bought the Moon.
No, I don't know that one.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, anyway, it's a short story and written for a children's book, a compilation thing. And I started adapting that as a script, thinking Edinburgh, you know, cool, like a 50-minute script. And I found it the other day. I thought, this is quite good. who wrote this? Anyway, sorry, we kind of started off going into the sort of creative process, but you know, the sort of hook I was hanging this podcast on was words and,
yes,
and ideas in writing. So in the manner of Ready Steady Cook, you brought along a carrier bag with a word in it.
I have got a word with me.
You want me to do the sound effect?
Yeah, if you want to. Yeah, sound effect.
Okay.
Go for it.
Okay, this is the carrier bag being opened. Okay. And what's in there? what's the word?
Journey.
Okay. All right. Can I give you my word?
Yeah, go on.
Because this might not come as a surprise to you as well, but I really struggled to decide what my word would be in the first of these kind of formats. But anyway, palimpsest.
Yeah, I saw that. That's not even a word I know.
I
want to get to know it, and then I need to know how to pronounce it because it's complicated.
Yeah, it's. I love it. I love everything about the word.
Say it again.
Palimpsest. It ends in a T.
Oh, palimpsest. Okay.
Palimpsest. Yeah. P-A-L-M-I. Sorry, hang on. P-A-L-I-M-P-S-E-S-T.
Okay.
All right. So I read this word years ago. You know, you read words and you don't know how to pronounce them.
Yeah.
And you know, quite often I come across them and don't know what they mean. But, and obviously this was the case. And I think I sort of skimmed over it, thinking, oh, that's a pretentious word, which of course it is. And then I looked it up, and then I got really interested because it sounds kind of abstract, but actually what it is, it's, you know, ancient Egyptians and Babylonians and so on used to write on pieces of reed woven together as the sort of paper. Yeah. Well, because that was quite an expensive and long process, they used to scrape off the ink of old manuscripts and write over the top.
How fascinating.
Yeah. So what happened is that, of course, you get a faint impression of what was previously written underneath what's newly written, and that's called a palimpsest.
Lovely.
Yeah. So it means that when you write something, there's a sort of residue or an echo of something you might have read or written before in what you write.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'm thinking a lot currently about, partly because I'm doing a couple of, I'm looking at a couple of playwriting competitions, and they've kind of got themes which kind of link together, and they kind of feed into this, which is kind of what I've been thinking about in terms of, you know, the word I've been, which is journey, which looking at, you know, where I've come from and where I'm going to, but that sense of detaching myself from other people's expectations of what that journey should have been, but also detaching myself from my perception of what other people's expectations of what my journey should. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I think I'm dreadful at that. And that's part of that. You know, there's you know, we have our whole histories, which, you know, we want to forget about in many ways. But actually, no, that's our story and it's our journey.
No, I think that's true.
And everything has got such value, whether we see it at the time or not, or whether we see it as something that people expected us to do or not expected us to do, or we regret or we don't regret. Actually, it's all part of that texture and that story. That's
So a journey and a palimpsest, they're definitely linked in that, aren't they? Because everything you write, and this can be one of the things that inhibits you, I suppose. Everything you write contains in it little bits of things you might have written before, or echoes of what you've written before. Do you find that?
Yeah, I certainly think, and I've learned to embrace it, I think. It's that sense of sort of your thumbprint of you as a writer. That, you know, there's a point I think, oh, I'm doing that again. And I think, actually, well, what's wrong with that? That's kind of what you do. I'm a big fan of Madness. I love Madness. I've always loved their, you know, the way they view the world, their melodies and all those kind of things. And there's something that is a thumbprint track of theirs. And it, you know, if they abandon that, well, it wouldn't be them. I think we should embrace those kind of things completely.
So what we're talking about? Oh yeah. Let's go back over the words, the two words. So palimpsest and journey are connected. They're kind of two ways of saying a very similar thing, aren't
they? They very much are.
That your history informs what you're writing now. Oh, that was a point. Yeah. So sometimes, I don't know whether you feel this, sometimes you're inhibited from basically writing something or writing in a way that you've written before.
Sometimes, I mean, I have been. I've been very conscious that actually I'm going down avenues I've gone down before, or the voice sounds similar. I mean, obviously you get different actors reading parts and things change anyway.
Yeah.
But I think I've learned to embrace my voice in my writing. This is the writer that I am, you know, and I am that because of that history. You know, I couldn't be something that I'm not. I mean, it's quite nice to sometimes to do something different and to challenge myself and, you know, work outside my comfort zone, as it were. But at the same point, yeah, I mean, the work we've taken.
Well, I don't know.
Go on.
Yeah, go on. I was going to say, I don't know whether you need to work outside your comfort zone. I mean, you always want to kind of push yourself.
Well, I mean, the example I was thinking last week, I did a piece for Radio Kent, which was completely out of my comfort zone to the point it surprised me a bit because I really liked it.
Yeah.
But it was like, well, this is new. Where's this come from? And I must admit, I sat on it for about a day thinking, no, they won't want this. And then I send it in and they used it as the main piece and that kind of thing they did. And I was like, this is interesting. And I enjoyed that. But again, it was just a world away from anything I've done before. But at the same point, actually, it drew on two strands of what is a typical Ian thing. One point is, you know, quite a introspective kind of self-analysis piece of writing, and also the same point a bit of 80s music sort of mashed together,
right?
That's me,
of course. Yeah, so I wonder, you know, because I made some notes about what we might talk about, and I was thinking of the thinking about themes in your writing, and interesting what we just said about kind of feeling hesitant about committing yourself to paper or writing the same thing, not the same thing, but, you know, writing in the same way.
Mm.
Actually, I don't know. Maybe you can write the same thing over and over.
I'm sure some people do.
Well, I suppose, and I guess that's really my question about how much you feel writing is kind of exposing yourself to the audience or exposing something personal to the audience, and whether you feel I don't know, either guilty about that because it's revealing or it's sort of self-indulgent because you're kind of using it as therapy.
I think I wouldn't feel bad about doing that, and mainly that's because of the experience we had of being Frank, and actually also the experience we had of, you know, From Today Everything Changes, in that, you know, I put elements of my story, or we put elements of my story on stage. But actually what happened was audiences connected with that and went, actually, that's my story. How did you know my story? And so I think what I learned through that is actually, if I'm able to tap into the things that are going on in my brain and in my life and in my, you know, that I'm struggling with, and actually you know, use that in my writing, actually it connects with audiences in very honest and very real ways. In a way that actually, I mean, you know, I occasionally churn out stuff just for fun, you know, silly little, you know, comedy things. And I enjoy them and people laugh at them, but I don't get the same buzz or feedback as I do from something like, you know, Being Frank.
Yeah. Well, we should probably talk about Being Frank because it seems like years ago. And I suppose it does, doesn't it?
It was a year ago.
It was a year ago.
Where we were doing this.
We were rehearsing it and then up in Edinburgh in August. But that started, well, actually, I guess it started not very much earlier, and it was always up against time, wasn't it?
Yeah, we definitely were working against the clock with that one, but I think that really helped it. It didn't overstay its welcome as a piece at all. If anything, people wanted more from it, which was nice. That's the criticism people had. It was too short.
Well, I guess the other thing is that you make decisions quickly, don't you?
Yeah, but it was nice. I think it was an experiment. I mean, before that, I'd written a script, and then we turned up with a script and we worked it. And then occasionally you'd say, Ian, that bit's rubbish, get rid of it. And I'd really like it. And that's fine. With Frank, it was really, you know, it developed as we were workshopping it. And a lot of that came out of the work I did with Frantic Assembly and with Punch Drunk, which really kind of influenced, you know, the way I thought about devising and creating characters and creating stories and allowing them to be quite organic rather than me kind of trying to force them down a corridor, as it were.
Yeah,
but it was kind of I think for all of us, it was a really interesting process to go through that in kind of putting that together.
Yeah.
And really proud of how it came out. It was terrific.
So, and it did resonate with audiences, didn't it?
Very much so. Very much so. You know, so many people, you know, tweeted or spoke to us or, you know, emailed or whatever, just saying, you know, that was my story. How did you know my story?
Yeah.
We had some very interesting, I'll say, frank conversations with audience members after shows who wanted to talk about, you know, their own journey, as that word again, because of what we put in front of them with being Frank.
Well, and I guess that as you alluded to, that happened with previous shows as well, didn't it?
It did.
And you're right, that is quite I mean it's a seriously moving thing, isn't it, when after the show people want to speak to you about
it's kind of humbling, actually. I found it. It's affirming in the sense that you think, okay, you know, because I mean, particularly with Frank was so personal and so raw. You know, I remember the first night we did it in Edinburgh, and I was really, really worried that, you know, people just weren't going to get this, and then they did, and it's like you know, weight came off my shoulders. But no, it was humbling to see how people then took that and made it part of their story, or used it to talk about their story. Which, incredible.
Yeah, I guess that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, you know, you could say the same for Transpennine, which was the year before.
Yeah.
But that was much more written piece, wasn't it? And there was a kind of there was a narrative arc, wasn't there?
Yeah, there's very much a narrative arc.
There was a story being told, and it was entertaining. But you were still kind of nervous about how it would be received.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because we're handling, you know, real human situations and real human stories, and, you know, I see that as a very precious and responsible thing. You know, I want to present this right. I don't want to offend people. I want people to take something from what we present to them and actually, you know, I don't know, change the world in some way, I suppose. It sounds cheesy, but yeah, absolutely. You know, we change people's perceptions, and we did in Transpennine. You know, we took that to a, you know, mainly cis, you know, audience, they learned something about trans people, and that was a really humbling thing to do. You know, and to tell, you know, cause it was my friend's story, my friend Kat. It was her story that we were telling, and it had an impact on an audience, and it changed people's perceptions, and that was terrific.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So the other thing that occurred to me, and I've got it written down on my little bit of paper, or like kind of prompt, is that when you talk about these plays that kind of deal with or touch on an issue, they can sound very preachy and worthy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're not. I mean, in performance, they're not. So,
I think because they're honest. I think because we're not, you know, constructing, you know, pretentious stories out of something. You know, being frank was honest. It was not. It wasn't just my story. It was other people's stories, kind of woven together. But at the same point, it was told in a very. A friend of mine came to see it, and she described it as raw. She said that was really raw. And I think, yeah, it is. It is raw. It's not sugar-coated. It's not, you know, it hasn't got a lovely coat of paint on it to make it pretty. It's, yeah.
Yeah, I think I think that was one of the most important things about it, was that it wasn't tying up all the loose ends. Mm. And it wasn't saying, here's a big problem, here's what you have to do about it.
Yeah, that's right. It was the start of a conversation, effectively.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, it was nice that people took that and then entered the conversation.
Is that something you've learned as well? I mean, before I knew you, you were still writing stuff, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. And I think back then I was much more into writing stories rather than actually exploring myself and, you know, life through theatre. I think that's been a shift over the last kind of 4 or 5 years. And that's actually... yeah, being quite strange. But at the same point, and I think this is this word of yours that I can't pronounce still, palimpsest or something. That one, that's the one. You know, my love of storytelling still comes through what I'm writing. It's kind of one part, as you said, one part is kind of woven in with the other part.
So how did you get started writing then?
I've just always...
wasn't meant to be a funny question.
No, it's one of the things. I don't think you ever sit down and think, do you know what, today I'm going to become a writer. I just like stories. I've always liked telling stories. I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, when we used to play with the guys, on, you know, the kids on the street and stuff. Hmm. And if you didn't have any kind of make-believe game, well, it was my job to kind of create the make-believe world that we were going to play in. You know, and that's always kind of been... how my brain's worked, really. So
that's interesting. You felt it was your responsibility.
No,
to
it was kind of what I did. You know, some kids are good at football, and I was good at telling stories, or you know, creating these worlds that we could kind of play in. And then, you know, as a young you know, elder teenager, young man. I was working in a church youth group, in a theatre group, and writing for them, and that kind of like got me going. And then, yeah, I've always liked telling stories in one form or another, and I think when I went to university, I did a degree in theatre and film because I wasn't sure, which kind of route I really wanted to be, working in. And I think what I found there and what I've continued to find since is I just love the immediacy of the theatre. I love watching an audience or hearing an audience respond to a piece, to a character, to a moment.
Yeah.
And as you said, having those conversations at the end, it's just, it's very powerful.
It's a strange thing to try and explain, isn't it? Particularly if you're trying to explain it to people who don't go to the theatre.
Yeah.
Because why would you go and sit in a little room with 100 other people or 200 other people you don't know to watch people you don't know pretending to be people when you can go home and watch, an amazing construction of millions of pounds on a soundstage?
But it's that immediacy, isn't it? It's that that raw energy that you've got in that moment that's never repeated. A show might be, we did Being Frank over 2 weeks. But no two shows were the same. Every one had its own energy and emotion.
It is that, isn't it? Something to do with a kind of, I know it's unspoken. It's a sort of feeling of response you get from an audience. Mm. I remember either, being on the audience side or being on the stage, seeing the look on people's faces. Or in some cases, seeing the tears.
Yeah, yeah.
And that impacts on the whole performance, doesn't it?
Very much so. I think when you're performing something, you are very much in tune with the audience's emotion and whether they're with you or not. That sweet moment, when you've got them, and they're completely with you emotionally.
Yeah,
yeah. That's an incredible moment. And I love this. I love the cinema. I love film, but it's a very, very different response and experience from that.
Yeah, I wonder the sort of role of the writer in that. I mean, it's really difficult. So, I like to defend the words in rehearsal, not necessarily as an actor, but as a director, I like to stick to the script.
Yeah,
but they are so important, but. They're absolutely nothing without the performance, aren't
absolutely,
they?
Absolutely, absolutely. As a writer, I can spend hours over a sentence getting it till it flows how I want it to be, and then I'll come back to it 3 days later and think, nope, that's not right, and I'll play with it again because I like playing with tenses and past tenses and all present tenses and all kinds of things in monologues and stuff. I think it gives it things that it just makes language interesting.
Yeah.
And absolutely. There are times when I've had actors say, Ian, can this script just, can I change this? I'm like, no, I spent ages writing that and I wrote it like that for a purpose. No, you can't. Yeah. But at the same point, you get those words in the right actor's mouth and wow, we've got the new one, Him for Canada.
Yeah.
Which we should have been going to Edinburgh with this summer and we can't do it. And I'm desperate to get that, moving and hear it and see it because, it's a level.
Yeah, I reread that yesterday and it's that's literally about a journey, isn't it?
It really is.
Several journeys, in fact.
Yeah.
And it's literally about the kind of impact of actions and thoughts and feelings of years ago on the present. So
it's very much about how we allow as you said, things that happen to hold us back in our lives and to kind of stop us doing the things we want to do. And at the same point, forgiving ourselves and, allowing healing to take place rather than this continual need to punish and go over, which our brains do, go over the bad things. But actually, it's very much about journeys.
I wonder why do you think that's universal? I think it probably is universal, isn't it?
I think it's a basic human condition. We see what we want and then we find reasons why we can't have it or we can't do it or we can't go there.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very human thing.
Yeah. I mean, unless you're Donald Trump, of course. But,
yeah, but absolutely. But, you know, I think every, you know, every life, whether it's, you know, you're the richest billionaire on the planet or whatever, has got incredible riches in it. You know, it's just, you know, it's different riches.
Yeah.
And I think we just need, you know, I'm learning to embrace the riches that I have rather than worrying about the riches that I don't.
No, that's a really good point. Yeah. And yeah, I wonder if, I don't know whether, when, what kind of stuff do you read? Does that inspire you as well?
What do I read? I read all
sorts. I mean, I'll give you time to think about that.
books that have really kind of impacted me wise. I mean, the Philip Pullman Dark Materials trilogy, I just adore.
Yeah.
I just think the richness of those stories is incredible. I loved things like The Shadow of the Wind, but kind of, you know, modern gothic kind of stuff like that.
Yeah. But I just wonder whether it has a direct impact on that.
Yeah, mainly I've been reading plays of late, actually, rather than literally, you know, novels, which is a gap in my reading at the moment.
Well, no, I mean, I don't read that many novels. But I was wondering what to... Because I always find that, you know, the kind of the latest thing I've read influences me the most. And I feel that's a weakness in me because I could have blown by the wind either way.
I just think, you know, I like stories in whichever way they come at me. And if it's a, you know, if it's an engaging narrative, then I'm there. You know, I've just been, I downloaded a game the other day, which I played through this morning, which is it's a narrative. You play through someone's dream. You go through the narrative of this dream. You don't have to fight anything or kill anything or anything. It's literally just an exploration of this character's dream. And it was amazing. You know, but it was just pure narrative where you walk through this dream and you engage with parts of the dream.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing really kind of, you know, sets me all kind of goosebumpy as well, because it's just, it's kind of a modern way of telling stories. That's, you know,
what's that called?
It's called The First Tree.
Okay.
Yeah, right. The First Tree. Loved it.
Yeah, have a look at that. Mm. So yeah, well, that's interesting. You know, I'm quite keen / obsessive about The Grinning Man.
Yes.
Did you see that?
I loved The Grinning Man. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I saw the other day that there's an immersive 3D version of it been filmed, and is due to be released, I think, later this year. Yeah, so that's quite interesting, isn't it? The sort of crossover between theatre and that kind of digital.
Yeah, very much so. And I think there's been interesting work in that done over the last few years. I'm a great admirer of there's a studio based in Brighton called the Chinese Room, who developed what was, you know, became labelled as the walking simulator. But it's basically, it's a novel on your feet. You walk through this, you know, arena that they create in interacting with characters and things, and you learn, and that's how you get the story. And deeply rich in. Yeah, I love that kind of stuff.
I think I somewhere in the back of my mind, I think there's a Brighton studio involved in this thing as well. In fact, I think it's something to do with Andy Serkis.
Okay.
But I'll have to check that out. But look out for it anyway.
We'll do.
Yeah. I think that actually comes back to what you were saying about the audience, and I was saying about the participation of the audience, because when we're in that little venue in Edinburgh, the presence of the audience actually is essential, isn't it? The fact
completely.
That they're on three sides of you and about, I don't know, half a meter away from me.
The energy that they give you, and I don't know, it's that immediacy, isn't it? It's that, you know, that people literally within 6 inches of where you're performing.
Yeah.
There are people watching you doing this. It's a fabulous experience.
And I guess, and the other thing that strikes me is the fact that there's no pause button.
No.
Once the audience are in, they're in for the ride, and they're buckled up and they can't get out. But there is a sort of committing yourself to that is, I think, important, isn't it?
Very much so. I think as an audience member and as a performer, it is. I mean, obviously, with the Edinburgh experiences, you have a space for an hour. Get in, perform, get out. You can't waver from that in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Which does create a real. Again, I keep coming back to the word energy. It does create a really interesting energy. in that space. And as you know, as we know, each audience brings in a different energy anyway, and you're responding to that, and you're soaking that up, and you're feeding that back.
I'm gonna refer to my emergency questions.
Okay, go on.
Well, they're not really emergency questions, not like Richard Herring's. I had this thinking about words and are there any words that you would want to not destroy or remove, but maybe put in a museum for the future? Are there words that you don't like or you don't want people to use?
I'm allowed to say Brexit. Is that a word?
That's
I'd like to put that word in a museum. Something we look back and go, that was a strange old time we went through.
Given the number of swear words that are in your script, I think that's very restrained.
Am I too sweary? I don't know. I do wonder sometimes. Am I my work too sweary? Sometimes I like to swear. So. Sometimes I like to run it back.
Well, sometimes they're kind of powerful, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think my language is gratuitous, but you know where it's. You know, if a character is that way out, the character is that way out.
Yeah.
And or a situation, you know, if it's, as you say, if it adds power to the moment, then great. But no, I think of any words I really, really can't stand.
No.
And to be honest with you, sometimes old words coming back are quite fun anyway.
Yeah, I don't know whether this is your experience. I was having this conversation the other day. Actually, I say conversation, it's probably on Twitter. But my memory of the childhood up north, as was yours, was that people around me relished language.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And I think, you know, the nuances that people were into their language as well, you know, the tones, inflections, things, it's very, very rich, lots of colour.
Yeah, and so I was wondering whether that was just nostalgia or whether it was. I like to think it's a feature of the northern kind of sensibility.
But I think it is. I think even if you know, I mean, I'm suddenly reminded of Guy Garvey as a lyricist and how you know, rich his lyrics are, and you know, he's from that kind of area, isn't he? And
that's interesting because I think it's sort of something I think about. In scripts, the sort of specific nature of language, you know, particular choice of words says so much about characters, and it's almost a sense in which that's when words are not familiar, you know, they're not kind of they don't trip off the tongue, they're even more characterful. If you see what I mean, if the audience don't necessarily. It's not necessarily their language. They're kind of drawn into it a bit more. Do you know what I mean?
I think I do. I think
there's a sort of power in people being very particular about what words they use.
Yeah, and I think different characters will do that. I think for me as a writer, it's all about the characters. It's knowing your characters, and I think sometimes if I start writing something and I don't know my characters very well yet. It's never very good. But if you know your characters and you've got those characters that are particular and are articulate and are, or as some of my characters are, very profane. It kind of goes, you know, it fits and it gives it that three-dimensional shift that, you know, is what lifts the word off the page.
But do you have an idea? I mean, are you saying you have to have an idea of your characters before you write, or is it the process of writing that?
I think sometimes I start and the characters reveal as I'm going along, at which point once I've really got that, I will then go back in the script and I will revise what the character has said up until that point, so that it's right.
That's right, isn't it?
Because I mean, I do. You know, when I'm writing, I never start at the beginning and just work neatly to the end. You know, I tend to write 4 or 5 pages, then go back and revise and go back and revise. And each revision adds a bit on the end until I end up with a 30-page whatever where, you know, that's usually, you know, getting to know the characters and making sure the characters are speaking as those characters do and reacting as those characters should. and, you know, interacting and bashing off each other as characters should.
So that comes back to the thing you were saying earlier, which I've probably completely forgotten now, which was it was something really interesting that you were saying about how you write. The point I was making about things that stop you writing and feeling that you've got like a complete story or a complete handle on the characters.
Do you know, absolutely. No, it's liberating to know you don't have to do that, actually, but it will come. And again, I think something that held me back in writing in my younger years was kind of, am I doing it right? Am I doing this properly?
Yeah.
Have I got my character biographies for every character that I'm going to come up against? Have I planned it out in a nice Excel spreadsheet, how every kind of act is going to fall into place? And you hear these stories of writers do that. And as a, you know, young guy with anxiety, it was like, oh my God, I don't do that. I can't be a very good writer. I must stop writing. And actually, am I allowed to swear in this?
Yeah.
I just think bollocks to that and just write.
Yeah. 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 But that I think of all the things, that is just the overwhelming lesson, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you want to write, well, just write.
Just write. Just get on with it.
Just keep and then if you don't want to write, stop, and then
if you want to do some more, and if you're feeling the pressure, you need to get some done. Well, do you know what? Sit and you'll try and get into it and enjoy it. But
it's a peculiar thing, isn't it? It's a peculiar thing to want to write if you think about it, because so many people don't.
Absolutely, but it's like anything. You know, this world is full of so many different kinds of people. You know, again, go back to that thing I did for the radio last week, which was on the theme of why the arts matter. And it made me reflect on, actually, well, what difference has the arts made in my life? And I kind of realized that actually, before I kind of got into the arts, I was lost. I didn't know who I was. You know, I wasn't sporty. I wasn't, you know, traditionally academic. I wasn't any of these things. And I certainly didn't want to go down the pathway that, you know, that my society was pushing me in, which was, you know, you'll go and work in a factory like everybody else in our society ever has. But the arts made sense of me. But for other people, football makes sense of them, or science makes sense of them, or mathematics makes sense of them, or plumbing makes sense of them, or whatever it is, this is just what it is for me. And I don't think that makes me special or better or anything. It's just, you know, this is just what I do.
Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, could you see yourself, that journey, being different if certain things hadn't happened,
absolutely. I think if I hadn't discovered the arts or theatre, I'd have, I think I'd have just been a consumer. You know, I'd have been the guy who goes through life, who goes to the cinema, who buys a DVD, who, you know, goes to the pub, who goes to Mallorca for a week, who does all those things that everyone should do and we all expect to do because that's what life is, isn't it? And I think I'd have been that person. I think the arts put me on a very different path, and it's a path that I should have been on. But it's one thing I've been reflecting on recently, you know, we see in terms of about opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think I'm in a really fortunate position at the minute. I haven't got stuff on the West End stage, but I write things and people are genuinely interested in what I write, which is like, oh my God, when did this happen? This is quite nice.
Yeah.
But
that's good.
It's a lovely thing. But even without that, you know, this is what made sense of me. And I don't think I did. As I said, I think I'd have just been a consumer. I've kind of lost my train of thought a little bit there in my.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Because we can jump trains. It's fine.
Yeah.
I think we're all consumers anyway. I mean, I think there's a kind of this background noise that can easily overwhelm you.
I've kind of picked where I was going to go now. This sense of opportunity is, it's about creating, you know, places and forums where anybody who has that innate ability can do it. You know, I think in our society we put up obstacles left, right, and centre to people being creative. I think the onset of technology has helped. You know, I've got in my little office here, I've got more music tech than probably existed in a room 30 years ago, and I can do things that I could only dream of as a child. But you know, an 18-year-old kid from a working class area of Yorkshire just didn't have access to this kind of stuff. You know, you didn't have access to people who were interested in what you wrote. You were forced down how you should behave, how you should conform, how you should live your life, rather than exploring who you are and actually what you can contribute.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a real danger of sounding kind of self-indulgent when you're talking about creativity and self-discovery. And but as you rightly say, you know, people discover themselves through all kinds of
I think one of the things I'm passionate about at the moment is finding ways to get other people creative and tapping into their creativity and you know, giving them the freedom and to do that. In a way that I didn't 10 years ago.
No, that's a good point. So you mentioned your music there. You've written some stuff recently?
I have. I did, just for a pure challenge, really. One thing I kind of realised early in lockdown, I wrote a few kind of isolation theatre pieces, which were quite fun, but then people just expected more of the same. And I'm quite happy to do those from time to time, but I've been trying to push myself in different directions and explore different things. And so I did, I wrote a song which I got a bunch of friends to record in isolation from up and down the country, and that's been knitted together, and that sounds quite good. I'm quite pleased with how that turned out. And I said last week I did a very 1980s, it's almost Visage. You remember Visage? It's you don't remember Visage? They were awesome. Two hits, no, but they were really good. But it was the piece of writing that I did on reflecting on why the arts matter, and I wanted to put a piece of music underneath it that kind of reflected my youth when all that was going on. And so so that was that one.
Right at the end of this podcast then we can either play that bit of sort of choral music if you like, or we could play the bit you did for Radio Kent. What do you think?
Oh God, which do you prefer?
Well, I don't know.
This is your podcast. You can have whichever you like.
Oh, I don't know. Well,
Why don't I send you both of them and you can just tag them on the end, whichever one.
Okay. All right. I haven't heard the thing you did for Radio Kent, but if you want us to play that out,
it's up to you. I'm still a bit kind of surprised by that. When I first did it, I thought, God, does this sound really pretentious? I don't know.
Then
I listened and thought, no, I really like this.
Yeah.
And they liked it, and other people liked it, but it's just, it's just very different from.
But let's face it, they're desperate to fill airtime.
They are. He's probably glad. He's probably thinking, oh, will somebody please send some work? Yeah. Oh, this will do.
Yeah. I don't think that for a minute, no. But I was going to ask you that about writing music, and particularly lyrics, and whether you have a particular view about how that works, lyrics fitting with music.
I had a particular view on how lyrics work. I like writing lyrics, but I don't find writing lyrics as easy as I wish it was.
All right.
No, I tend to kind of throw things around for ages. I'd rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it and then think, no, it doesn't work. Why can't somebody else write my lyrics for me?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't
know. So when you have an idea for a song, do you have the lyric in mind? Or at least is it less?
Depends on the song. Sometimes a song will be a phrase or something will just be buzzing around my head and it'll form in my head as a little chorus or something or a hook. And at which point that's nice and easy, but then you've got to write a song from that. So if you imagine that's the seed that goes into the ground, then you've got to build a tree from what you've been planted in your head. Sometimes it's just a case of, you know, having a jam on the piano or whatever, and you know, a piece of music comes out, and then, you know, lyrics sometimes go on those, sometimes they don't, sometimes, you know, it's things.
But I guess the making of music is an end in itself anyway, whether it turns into something or not.
Oh, totally. It's you know, it does me good as a human being to sit and twiddle with a piano or play on a whistle or a ukulele or whatever and create something. I enjoy that process. It's good for me. It's good for my mental health, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And if other people enjoy it, then that's great. Again, it's one of those things I've learned as I've got, you know, as a teenager. I think, you know, we all went through that, dreaming of hitting the big time and, you know, all these kind of things. And I am my own first audience, is how I see it. If I enjoy a piece of music, then that's enough. If if other people do, that's a bonus. But it's like, you know, you and you're a painter and you do really good, really lovely artwork. You know, if you enjoy your artwork, why does somebody else need to validate that for you? And I'm kind of, I've got to the same point with my music, really. I enjoy it. I enjoy making it. People enjoy it. Brilliant. If people don't enjoy it, well, you know what? That's fine. I'm cool with that.
Yeah, I'm okay with that, except when people talk about it as a hobby.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's, oh, it's nice to have a hobby.
Yeah, it's not a hobby, is it? A hobby is like, really, I don't know, picking stamps in a book or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Well, how would you describe it? Like, just how would you describe
it? I don't know.
How would you differentiate it from hobby? Because you're right, it is different. But I suppose you're not getting paid for it, so is it a hobby?
Yeah, I maybe it's just reflective of my own insecurity, I guess. But it feels as if it's demeaning it to just call it a hobby, or, you know, I say just, but people dismissing it as a hobby, because I think it's something to do with aspiring to a sort of threshold of quality. Is it?
Yeah, it could be. It could be. It could be that sense of having that validation on what you've done or what you're doing.
But that just might make us sound really needy.
Well, we are. Yeah. I think let's embrace that. We are artists. We are needy. That's what we do. Yeah, we need people to affirm us and tell us we're good at what we do.
I mean, to be more charitable, it is also about sharing it, isn't it?
And, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm about to do something quite brave with my music, actually. I made a decision today. I'm just going to stick it out online and people can just download what they want. I've been sat on stuff for years and it's like, do you know what? I'm enjoying listening to this. If other people want to listen to this, there it is. You can have it.
That's cool.
I know.
Yeah. So how are you going to distribute it?
I don't know yet.
Okay. Well,
but I found a really cool website that does mastering for you. So when I create a piece of music, it comes out at a certain kind of level, but then anything you hear on the radio has gone through a mastering process to really kind of polish it and shine it and do the zing. And I spent years thinking, how do you do that? And like everything these days, there's a website for that.
Yeah.
And it's doing marvelous things in my music. So I'm going to master.
Well, like the website online that we're using right now, Zencaster.
Indeed, it's very clever.
It's all very good stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of drawing together the threads of that. What you've said, I think, but you can correct me, is just do the stuff you enjoy.
Literally, don't wait for somebody else to approve it, validate it, whatever. Just do it.
Yeah.
Do it.
Well, and also start doing it because it's stuff you enjoy, rather than thinking, oh, I can't do this, or I need to learn more, I need to go on a course.
Yeah. And I think the other thing as well is listen to people. You know, one thing I've realised recently is when people say, this is good, Ian, I don't believe them. I look for reasons to, oh, no, they don't really mean that. They're just saying that's generous. They just think that's be kind. They're just patronising me. They're just... Well, actually, do you know, sometimes people say, we like this. They actually mean it. Listen to them. Take that on board. Allow people to like what you do as well.
I'm really bad at that.
Oh, I'm dreadful at it. I'm dreadful at it. You know, did they say they like this? No, they didn't really mean that.
They were just being nice.
They were just being nice.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And actually,
but
they did like it.
Ooh. But it's kind of difficult to distance yourself from that, isn't it? Because obviously it's great to have that validation. But and I think I've learned this from you, is to take a step back and think, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
But because I enjoy it.
Literally.
And it worked for me, or it did, you know, I achieved what I wanted to achieve. So
it comes back to the thing I keep saying, is I am my own first audience. You know, I don't need anybody else to like this for me to like this. And if I like this, then... You know, other people, not everybody's going to like this. You know, I'm thinking back, we did Being Frank in Edinburgh last year, and we had some really good reviews, and people said, oh, yes, this is great, wonderful original music. And then one of the reviewers wrote, there's this really turgid song. I was like, oh, thanks for that. Yeah, and it got my brain latched onto that, rather than all the other people going, oh, my God, that was
so true, isn't it? So true. Bad review.
Oh, my God, yeah, totally.
That's hard. But
I laugh about it now, but it's interesting.
But it's kind of, unless you have those, you don't really understand them, do you? I mean,
no.
If you get a bad review and give up.
Yeah, absolutely.
you're not going to get all the buzz and the excitement and the and you're certainly not going to get better at what you do.
No, absolutely. And again, you've got to realise, you know, I am not for everyone. What I do, no, not everybody will like it.
Oh, come now.
That's fine as well.
Yeah, it's hard when it's your own parents, though.
Oh, well, that's true. But, you know, otherwise.
Right. So so your word was journey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So and now you've learned a new word.
I still can't pronounce it. But, yeah, it's a cool word.
Palimpsest.
Palimpsest. It sounds like something you've
got. I know. It sounds really dodgy. But so what? I know this is a really cheesy question, but where's next on the journey?
I'm exploring a few different things at the moment, really. I'm trying to, I'm going back to a couple of things I started writing and never got going properly. I looked at, for years and years and years, I've wanted to write a musical based on the story of the prodigal son. I don't know if I've ever told you that. And I've kind of started it a few times. And I went back to it the other day and looked at it and realised actually the problem with it that's kind of held it back is I've got the main character wrong. So I'm going to rewrite it and change the main character. Just exploring things for different kinds of performance, really.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to be in a rut and do the same thing and the same thing, but find different ways of exploring things and this theme of journey is kind of playing on me. One of the two there's two playwriting competitions which I'm really quite interested in. One has a theme of the road not taken.
Oh yeah.
And one has a theme of, I think there was hope, despair and endurance or something. And I thought actually you can kind of link those together.
Yeah.
And do something with that. And I'm really exploring this sense of, you know, that we've talked about with the two words. You know, our journey is what it is, what we are now, you know, that our previous journey is reflected in what we are doing now.
Yeah.
And actually, that's fine. You know, there's this sense, as I said, we talked about this sense of, you know, am I on the right journey? Did I take the right path? Am I doing what these people expected me to be doing? Oh, my God. And freeing people from that to be in a sense of, do you know what? This has been my journey. It's been really interesting.
Yeah. That's really cool. I'm pleased we've there seems to be so much else we could talk about because I want to talk about the kind of recurring idea of family, which mm-hmm. I think is in your
work. Yeah, very much so.
And maybe we're going to do this again. Maybe we'll do this regularly.
Yeah, it's just nice to talk, Phil. It's nice to talk.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. We don't do this often enough.
No, we're going to come around and see your puppy.
Yeah, anyway, that'd be great. That'd be great.
Listen, Ian, thank you very much.
Pleasure, thank you.
I'll let you know what it all sounds like.
Yay.
And when it's online and available.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
So much. So that was my chat with Ian Tucker Bell, and you can see and hear lots of Ian's work online via the Viral Theatre Festival website, which is www.viralfestival.net. And at The Orange Works, that's theorangeworks, all one word, .org.uk, and on SoundCloud. So don't forget to look out for new episodes of Ideas in Writing. We've got a couple coming up in the next few weeks, produced with Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge. And sad as I am not to play out on my own theme tune, but you'll hear that again, which is a great composition from Kevin MacLeod, not that one. As promised, here's the 80s tribute piece that Ian mentioned got featured on the BBC radio. It's called You Came. I'm Philip Holden, and thanks for listening.
I was a voice unheard, a sound without noise, a face lost in the crowd. A boy misunderstood, the piece that didn't fit, dreams shredded in doubt. Then you came, and I found home and purpose in you. A man misunderstood, in a world that didn't click, a silence in the storm. Words without sentence, hope without formation, expectation kept me from. Then you came, and I found home and purpose in you. You show ourselves in the worlds we created, reflections of thunder and pause. You grant me voice, ignite my mind, cause my heart to move. Because you came, and I found home and purpose in you. You came, and I found home and purpose in you. And I am not alone. I am not alone. I am.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. You just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.